The Athletic.
Hello and welcome everybody to this edition of The View from the Lane. You don't need to be told that it's from The Athletic, you don't need to be told it's multi-award winning, it's about Tottenham Hotspur, but those are the facts, those are the truths. And joining me, host Danny Kelly, from The Athletic today, Charlie Eccleshare and Jack Pitt-Brook. I'll say hello to those in just a second. Fantastic, I'm really hopeful about this episode. On today's episode, we'll be talking about what does the future hold for Eric Dyer, who spoke to us on his return to North London with Bayern this week. We'll talk about the life of a backup goalkeeper. Spurs' Alfie Whiteman reveals some really interesting hobbies. I suppose you'd call it a cultural hinterland as he waits for his chance in the first team. We've got a trip to Newcastle to discuss and an FA Cup semi-final for the Tottenham's women's team. And we'll look ahead to both. And finally, because we didn't really have time for it last week, after Mickey van der Ven's astonishingly powerful shot, which I declared my favourite Spurs goal of all time in one of those broad brush moments for which I later come to regret. We'll be discussing other fantastically powerful Spurs shots over the years. I've got a lovely list of, mine's got two, but they're very special goals and I'll tell you about them later. So a goal scoring return for Harry Kane in North London, the Champions League, Tuesday night. Of course it was. Hidden away from the spotlight in the heart of the Bayern Munich defence was Eric Dyer. A very low-key exit from Spurs in January. I thought he was pretty good against Arsenal, though the first goal was totally modern Eric where he retreats. I think sometimes the game changes, doesn't it? He's the worst player with his hands behind his back in the history of football. That's the problem, isn't it? Since they've been instructed to put their hands behind their back, he accompanies Eric with a retreat into the middle of the penalty area, which allows good strikers to use him as a kind of a mannequin around which to bend the ball, as we saw with the first goal in the Champions League game. That's only my opinion. I think he's not been helped by the pretend you're doing figure skating and put your hands behind your back. What did he have to say, Jack? What were the highlights of your time with Eric? How was he?
He was really good. He's a good player to interview, Eric, because he's very honest. He's very thoughtful.
Yeah.
He has opinions, like he's happy to back them up. And so I went over to Munich last week to go and interview him at the Allianz Arena. And, we talked about his time in Bayern, the first half of this season, where obviously he didn't play much, how the move came about and everything. And I think what struck me the most, or the most interesting thing about what he said, Danny, was his graciousness towards Postecoglou over what were a pretty miserable few months for him. You know, he's played, 364 games for Tottenham?
Wow.
And he's gone from being, an integral player for almost all those 9 years to being really kind of back of the queue, or bottom of the pecking order. You know, at the start of the season, he wasn't making the bench behind Phillips. It took him a while to even get any involvement. And clearly, Postecoglou preferred even Davis and Royale to fullbacks at centre-back ahead of Dyer. But he was really positive about Postecoglou. He said he didn't take it personally. He loved training with him. And, given how moany and grumpy players get when they don't play, I was really slightly surprised and very impressed by his sort of warmth and respect towards Postecoglou after that time.
I really, really enjoyed working under him, and I learned a hell of a lot. I would love to sit down and talk to him now. I'd have so many questions for him. Not about me, just about the way he does certain things and why he does them. Hopefully, one day I'll be able to, because I'm very interested in the way that he went about things.
Could you sense that? Does he miss Spurs, or is he just so thrilled to be playing the quarterfinals of the Champions League that he'll wait till his career's over before he starts saying how much he misses me personally and the whole Spurs thing?
I certainly think he is very thrilled to be at Bayern, playing for one of the biggest teams in Europe, playing for a great manager with great teammates, and of course in the Champions League quarterfinal.
It was the most challenging 6 months, I think, of my career. It's really not a nice position to be in, where obviously you're not at all. I try to stay calm and analyse it in a practical way, and I understood that it was very clear that obviously there was a new manager and he wanted to start something new, and obviously when you want to do that you you know, there are players like Harry who left, yeah. and Hugo, and then myself, you know, who have been there a long time, and it was obviously time to move on, and the club would to start something fresh, you know, and something new. I understood that. I understood like what my contractual situation was, that I only had a year left, and I understood that the club were going to want to start fresh. So I understood those things. So I didn't take it in a very personal way or anything like that. It was still, obviously, you don't play for 6 months and it's what you want to do. It's the thing you want to do most. It's very challenging. Being here now, you know, I think the thing I'm most proud about myself is that I just persevered, you know. I trained hard every day, tried to stay as fit as possible. And it's blind faith because you don't know if you're going to go anywhere in January or where you're going to go or what's going to happen. Yeah. It's purely blind faith, but you don't see the light at the end of the tunnel, you know. And then suddenly I was here. And it was a great feeling when I arrived here that for 6 months I behaved in the way I did. It made me very proud that I behaved in the way I did for those 6 months, because I felt like it's what opened the door to coming here, and it's also why when I came here I was ready.
I think he's very warm towards Spurs. You know, he spoke very, very positively about the relationships he has with Spurs, the, you know, the players, staff, fans, even Daniel Levy he's got a lot of respect for. And how much he's looking forward to that friendly, which Bayern are playing at Tottenham, I think, on the 10th of August at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. And he said that he told me that he'd had a conversation on the phone with Daniel Levy when he left, and they discussed the possibility of, I think Levy said that the club were working on some kind of farewell type event for Kane and Dyer at that game. Because obviously, you know, the way it works in football is that generally players leave in a bit of a hurry. And neither Dyer nor Kane has had any kind of real sort of send-off from the Spurs crowd. So I think something is planned around that game.
Can I just say something on? I mean, it is kind of amazing how much, the extent to which Tuchel clearly really rates Eric Dyer, that he was starting ahead of Upamecano and Kim Min-jae in the Champions League quarter-final on Tuesday. I mean, those are two players kind of perennially linked with Spurs. And yeah, just the idea, you know, how much Spurs fans are kind of like, oh, I'm so desperate to get either of these players and we can finally shift Eric Dyer. And then you've got the Bayern manager going with Dyer ahead of both of them. You know, and as Jack says, a player who couldn't even make the Spurs bench for a lot of the season.
I don't know whether that says something about the recruitment at Bayern, or maybe just Tuchel feeling like he, you know, in a difficult spot, he really wants to rely on kind of his players rather than, you know, players who are very experienced at that top level and who he has a really good relationship with. Because Upamecano and Kim Min-jae, obviously, like, in their own right, very good players. Like, you know, Upamecano starts with France and Kim's been one of the best, you know, but fantastic at Napoli last season.
Right, that's I guess you have to call Eric a former Spurs player now. But Jack, you've also been talking to a current Spurs player, though you'd hardly know it with his appearances. But it turns out that Alfie Whiteman is one of the, well, you know, Spurs, I guess, third choice goalkeeper, fourth choice goalkeeper after Austin, I'm not sure. Alfie Whiteman is a player with much more cultural backwater, cultural hinterland than most, or the way we presented them. How did you come across Alfie's other interests, as a matter of interest yourself, before you went and talked to him?
I think I first made aware of this when I think he did an interview with maybe the Spurs programme or the Spurs website where he... You were talking about Radiohead. Not exactly a niche band, but not a band you'd imagine many footballers are into. Then he brought out this famous NTS show, which was a big surprise. You know, this is the show which he put out. It's like an hour long mix. It starts with David Axelrod, Cocteau Twins, Elliot Smith, all sorts on there. Have you listened to it, Danny?
No, I haven't actually. But
I thought it'd be right up your street.
It sounds like it, doesn't it?
And off the back of this, I then got in touch about interviewing him, and then spoke to him the other week about, you know, his interests and his football, and, you know, what it's like being a footballer who is really into doing his own photography and making mixes and going and all that and that kind of stuff. And he was really nice. He was very, again, very thoughtful, very interesting, very fascinating perspective on life, the challenges of being a goalkeeper who doesn't play, and how he kind of gets in the mindset every morning for training. And I really, really liked him. I think he's a great guy.
I mean, Charlie, there's a little bit of classism, I always think, in the way footballers are always portrayed as being a bit dim. We don't do it on The Athletic, but it has been the traditional way of presenting footballers. And of course, you could argue they've got already got one fantastic way of expressing themselves, which is, you know, to play a physical activity at the level that they do. I remember spending some time with Jody Craddock, the former Wolves centre-half. He's a really, really brilliant painter. Very, very talented indeed, Jody. In fact, in my very short list of sportsmen who are great painters, only Jack Russell, the former England wicketkeeper, is above him. Well, Jack is displayed in London galleries now and all the rest of it. Did you know about this Alfie Whiteman business, Charlie?
No, I've spoken to Alfie before, but that was a kind of classic footballer interview that was kind of about the football side of things. Before this kind of side, this was years ago, before this side of him was well known. It was with him and Brandon Austin. But actually, I remember talking about this topic after I'd interviewed Eric Dyer a couple of years ago, and he talked about various other interests he had and what have you in his cultural hinterland, and speaking there about how much it frustrates me, the perception about footballers that you mentioned there, Danny. And this is something I can't help but bite when, like, friends of mine or people meant, you know, sort of make those lazy assumptions, stereotypes about football. It really annoys me because I do think there is a massive class element to it.
Yeah.
I also think it's just a shame because football's so big now that players are so tightly controlled in what they can and can't say that, you know, it's kind of in everyone's interest often for them to just say the same platitudes and, you know.
Yeah.
And so I think they have so much more to give, and they're often not really allowed to give that. And also in the confines of, you know, so often the context in which footballers are interviewed is in a mix zone with a scrum of people around them chucking phones in their face, and they've got 3 minutes to answer some questions. Clearly in 3 minutes, you're not going to get onto what films do you like at the moment.
Is it a massive fan of Kurosawa? Yeah, who knew?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's just not going to happen. So I just think it's so much of it is the environment that they're often. And also they, a lot of the time, I think not only is there not enough time for them to talk about it, not only are they tightly controlled so they don't, I think a lot of them would think it's just not that interesting. They would think, oh, well, all that, you know, the fact that I'm interested in XYZ, they won't want to know about that. They'll want to know about, you know, the fact that I feel settled at Club X. And so I just think it's so great when you can, when you get an interview like this, which I thought was brilliant and it was so interesting. And when you have that way in and when they feel comfortable to talk about this sort of thing. And, you know, Alfie mentioned it in Jack's interview. He said he's done a lot of this stuff previously kind of anonymously because he doesn't want it to be just that he's using his platform as a footballer and taking advantage of that. But yeah, no, I love interviews like this. They're my favourite ones to do, favourite ones to read. And yeah, I hope other footballers will read this and think, yeah, I wouldn't mind talking about my interest in topic Y.
I think there's two reasons why footballers can be a bit reluctant to talk about their outside interests, which are kind of connected. One is that if they put something out into the public domain, they're worried that they'll kind of only be known for that particular thing. Like it will be kind of pinned on them forever. I know because Alfie said to me, like, he's done mixes, he's kind of published mixes and stuff in the past, and he's done it, I think, under his mother's maiden name because he was a bit sensitive about people saying, oh, look, he's the Tottenham goalkeeper and he's now doing music. And I think there's also a sense, which is that they're worried that people will say that it's a distraction from football. Like, we all remember, you know, the Marcus Rashford thing.
Yep.
You know, people would always say to him, you shouldn't be out there campaigning about politics. You should be focusing on your football. And Alfie made the point to me, which is that lots of footballers will spend a whole day on a golf course. And that's like a perfectly, you know, that's a perfectly legitimate way to spend a day off. But nobody says, you know, I can't believe he spent a whole day on a golf course. No. You should focus on his football. But if you do something which is slightly unusual, whether that's politics or, in Whiteman's case, DJing, or like not DJing so much, but like making mixes and being interested.
Just having an interest, a wider interest in music,
Taking photos or whatever. There are some activities where people will say it's distracting. And I do think that footballers are quite sensitive to the accusation that they're not sufficiently focused on their day job.
Look, there is a slightly, as well as that, there is another thing, isn't there? And that is the reaction it gets in the dressing room. Now, footballers may have changed, but I doubt they've changed that much. We all remember that Graham Nassau, just because he read a broadsheet newspaper, was
The Guardian,
mocked by his fellow professionals. And I forgive me if I've already told this story, but I have talked to Pat Nevin about this. Pat, of course, was, you know, 30, 40 years ago, was openly interested in all kinds of books and music and stuff. And he told me a great story. When he was playing for Clyde, he would get the New Musical Express. He used to go to training on the train. He would get the New Musical Express and put it on top of his training kit in his bag, because he knew that as soon as he got to the training ground, the other players would get it, tear it into tiny shreds and throw it into the shower, which is what they did. They were so appalled by somebody reading about music that they found challenging. But Pat's a clever man. He had a second copy at the bottom of his training bag to read on his way home on the train. So he had, we got an extra reader out of it as well. He had to buy two copies to survive the prejudices of footballers.
I remember talking to Espen Bardsson about that as well. He was famously a kind of very academic, intellectual footballer who then went into a career in the City. And him saying, I mean, again, this is like the late 90s, but him saying he got all sorts of grief for reading his economics textbook and this sort of thing. But I think nowadays it's better, you know, like,
I'd hope so.
Like Ben Davis have done degrees at the Open University. And again, you know, they're not, you know, screaming and shouting about this. They're probably doing it in their understated way. But I thought Alfie made a really good point as well, that not only should they not be condemned for doing this, it should be encouraged, because it, you know, it makes you a more rounded individual. It's good to get away from football sometimes and do other things. So yeah, really, really interesting. I also think like there is a balance to be struck, and Jack and I talked about this, I think either before he did the interview or after, but before writing it. Like you don't want to fall into that trap of like patronizing footballers and doing the kind of like, oh look, he said a clever thing, you know, and that's
it's
what
it's like.
That's
a dog
exactly
that can use a mobile phone. It's just the cutest thing you've ever seen, isn't it? Jack, the final thing on Alfie. Alfie's also 25 years of age. What did he reflect, or did you talk about the fact that he's probably been a professional footballer now for 8 years, I suppose, since he got his first professional contract, and has played for the club he's registered with, Tottenham, once?
Yeah, so he clearly wants to play. He wants to play football. He talked a lot about how, you know, you work very hard in the week and you want to play a football match at the end of the week. He's not ambivalent about whether or not he plays football. You know, you can see that by, he's had these two loans in Sweden. You know, obviously didn't go on loan this season, came back, was working really hard in pre-season and then broke his leg, which has really, you know, damaged his, sort of obviously put him out for quite a while. He's back fit again in training now, but it's really kind of impeded his season. I don't know what the future holds. You know, eventually, you know, there'll come a point where I imagine he'll want to make a decision about whether or not he wants to go somewhere, maybe on loan or permanently, where he might play more. But I certainly think, I mean, he clearly is motivated by wanting to play games. It's not the case that he doesn't care about playing or not, because he is motivated by playing.
Yeah, I mean, given the form of Vicario and the tendency of English clubs to make up their quota by having a veteran English goalkeeper as backup, I suspect he probably has to think about himself and moving on. Listen, thank you for those two things that you did, Jack. They were, you know, in a different ways, fascinating insights into players who we normally get, you know, we shine a very strong light at them. It's all reflected back at us without learning a single thing. Let's have a break, then we can talk about the game against Newcastle. They're all important now, but this is a very important one. But that's coming up next here on The View from the Lane. Yeah, welcome back to The View from the Lane. I'm Danny Kelly, Jack Pitbrook and Charlie Eckshow with me. Up next for Spurs, the lunchtime kickoff for this Saturday away to Newcastle. 12 months on, Jack, from perhaps the worst Spurs performance of recent memory?
Yeah, so it was almost exactly this time of year. It was late April last year that Tottenham went to St James's Park and put in what I think is the worst I've ever seen, certainly any Tottenham team play. I think almost any team, any professional team play.
6-1.
Yeah, they lost 6-1. They were 5-0 down after about 25 minutes. It was the game that got Stellini the sack.
And Hugo Lloris never really recovered from it.
No, he never played for Tottenham again. It was also, Eric Dier played in the back four.
as did Porro, and that was seen as, that'll never happen again.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, I literally remember saying that this was part of the reason why this was such a disastrous selection, was they played Porro in a back four, you can't do that. And I think it's really interesting, one, just to kind of gawp at how awful it was, which we all did at the time and can do again in hindsight. But I think it's also revealing in the context of now, because it shows how quickly football can change. You know, last season, it was the first time that Newcastle finished ahead of Tottenham in the last 20 years.
Yeah.
And they finished, I think, about 11 points ahead of Spurs. And at the time, we all said, this is the sort of theme that Charlie and I talk about quite a lot. But at the time, the view was, Newcastle are the team of the future. They've got the Saudi money. They're in the Champions League. They'll be ahead of Tottenham forever. And this year, obviously, Tottenham are much better than Newcastle, as proven by the league table. And some of the players who were, that day, obviously, Porro was terrible. He's been brilliant this season. Saar was thrown in, started, hooked after 25 minutes. He's been brilliant this season. So it does just show that, things in football can actually change very quickly, and trends that feel like tectonically permanent at the time can, in fact, actually be reversed fairly briskly.
I mean, 5-0 after 21 minutes, was that a Premier League record at the time? Did City do that to Watford maybe at some point? I feel like there was some battering that was about that level.
It felt kind of unusual because obviously, Spurs were in this ridiculous, obviously Stellini had thought, right, I'm going to prove how different I am to Conte. It's going to be no more of this 3-4-3. We're going to play a 4-3-3, pour it right back. We're going to take the game to Newcastle. I remember seeing the team sheet, and I think I said to Luke Edwards, who covers Newcastle for The Telegraph, I think Tottenham are going to get destroyed here. But even then, I didn't think, what I didn't count on was how relentless Newcastle would be. Obviously, the crowd got massively up because they had great momentum at that point. And Newcastle basically scored every single attack. They scored basically, I think, every 5 minutes for 20 minutes until they were 5-0 up.
Thing is, though, I reckon there would have been quite a lot. I can't specifically remember. But when the team sheet came out, as well as that scepticism, I reckon there probably was also a dollop of, at least we're giving it a go here. We're not playing the back three anymore. Perhaps Saar's in. That's quite exciting. We're going with a more attacking lineup. Let's see how this goes. And then obviously, 3-0 after 9 minutes.
One of the great examples of the new manager reverse bounce, wasn't it? Where they drilled themselves into the earth from where they'd already fallen from a high building.
Yeah. Four games and out. Poor Stellini.
I mean, different thing this time around, but a really important game for Spurs. And I guess, Newcastle still maintain hopes of qualifying for one of the European tournaments themselves. The big thing for Spurs, I guess we know where the back five will be if everybody's fit and available. The front three, give or take. It's the midfield three that we have to discuss. Where do we start with this? Because Højbjerg's performance 3 or 4 days ago has thrown a cat among the pigeons, a spanner into the works, whatever cliche you want to use. Or is he going to be the impact substitute until the end of his time at Spurs? Without putting you on the spot, guys, what should Spurs do and what do you think he might do?
Well, I looked at this for a piece that went up this morning, and it is interesting. Spurs have played 19 different combinations of a three. There have been a lot. And obviously a lot of that was injury, suspension, AFCON. Looking at it, James Maddison hasn't been benched for a Premier League game all season. So I think we can safely say he's going to start, assuming he's fit. So basically, he's also always played one of Pap Sarr or Bissouma, as long as one of them's been available. Mm-hmm. So I think we can safely assume one of them will start. I was speaking for this piece to some of the guys who cover Newcastle for The Athletic, and it was quite interesting because I was kind of saying, what would Newcastle least want to face? And they were saying that the thing they really struggle with, this midfield, especially without Joe Linton and Joe Willock most likely, is physicality and players who can kind of find spaces in between the lines. So I kind of feel this game will be perfect for Pap Sarr. Mm-hmm. So I'd be surprised if he didn't start. Again, fitness allowing, he's had this back issue he's managing.
You're very eloquently working your way to the actual nub of this, aren't you? The rub here is who plays six, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it comes down to who plays six. This is the most athletic answer ever for you. Rather than doing it in three words, I'm doing it in many, many more.
Yeah.
So then, it comes down to who plays six. Do you go Bissouma? Do you go Bentancur? Do you go Højbjerg? All of them have played it. In this piece, thanks to one of our data whizzes, Mark Kerry, look at kind of the different things that they offer. And Bissouma, numbers-wise, is perfect for this role. He's really one of the Premier League's best when it comes to carry and dribble volume, ball retention ability, link up play, but and also the defensive side, disrupting opposition moves and ball recoveries and interceptions. I think because he was so good early on, the narrative has been was really good, big decline, and there's some truth in that. Clearly, he was exceptional until he got that red card against Luton. But looking at it in the round, he still had a very good season and offers so much of what they need in that position. You know, it is a bit of a high wire act playing as a six for Postecoglou Spurs. You're getting the ball under pressure in deep positions. Bear in mind, Newcastle have got a front three you can press really well. Gordon, Isak, Barnes, if he plays. So I think he's the kind of safest pick. Yeah, so I think that's probably what I would do, and I suspect it might be what Postecoglou does. But that said, I wouldn't be surprised if Bentancur came in. I'd be most surprised by Højbjerg starting, just because he started so few games this season and has seemingly perfected this kind of super sub role.
I think the story of Højbjerg's season is that he's got quite a few very impressive substitute appearances behind him. I thought the other day was the perfect example of that, where he really kind of turned the game, I think, in the second half. So that he's really good at that role, but I think whenever he's had to start, he's not really been up with the pace of it. Like he's had a few games where he's had to start and he's, you know, been kind of struggles to sort of set the tempo with the ball. Like it's he doesn't really give them what the other two players in that position do. So I think I'd probably go for Bissouma, although it's quite a tight call between Bissouma and Bentancur. Although, this is kind of slightly off topic, but connected. One thing that I've saw recently, I think I've obviously stolen this idea off someone on Twitter. Somebody was saying that if you think of like what do Tottenham want to be like, and the answer is really they want to be probably more like Arsenal, more like Manchester City next season. Obviously, City and Arsenal have both got two absolutely world-class number six players in Rodri and Declan Rice. To what extent do you think that should be a priority in the summer market, given that Bissouma and Bentancur are clearly very, very good players in their own right? I think both of them can play as eights. I think maybe Bentancur is more of a natural eight. But do you think that Tottenham needs some kind of big, imposing, six-foot-plus counter-attack preventer to sort of break things up and get moves going? Obviously, such a player costs the best part of 100 million quid, so it might not be an option. But do you think that should be a priority in the market?
That's a really interesting question, because Bissouma, one of the accusations against him is that he hasn't been good enough at stopping counters. And you think of the Luton one in particular the other day. It is hard because, as you say, they've got those two very, very good options, and you can only prioritise so many areas, can't you? So whether they, or what they might look to do as well is get someone who can play six and an eight, so they've got a bit more flexibility. I think as well, if they're looking at Arsenal and City as kind of benchmarks, having multifaceted, multi-positional players is really important. And I think we've seen that a bit with what Spurs have done themselves. You know, someone like Timo Werner who can play across the front line, Dragusin can play as a fullback if needed. That would add a huge amount. But like you say, those players are not easy to come by. I mean, someone like Onana at Everton is someone who, you know, I think a lot of clubs will be looking at. Very, very good player.
I mean, the answer to your question, Jack, if I may, and this is actually a little bit of a defence of Yves Bissouma, unfashionable though that may be, is that it's a major change. The playing out from the back has created a major change in the way football teams technically operate. It used to be said that goalkeeping was the most difficult position because if you made one mistake in 90 minutes, it was amplified by the fact it caused a goal. In fact, that position is now number six. It is now the high-risk position in any team. And if you make a mistake there, and Bissouma has made mistakes, but everybody makes mistakes, but it tends to cost a shot at goal. It's become as exposed as goalkeeping because you don't have the cover of a double pivot normally. And in the way these teams are set up now, there's all kinds of reasons why the person receiving the ball on the half turn in the defensive third of the pitch is the most exposed player in football teams.
Look, even Rodri last week against Palace made some errors.
Absolutely. And of course, immediately it cost them because that's the way the teams are set up. So if you have a player who's phenomenally consistent, they need to be physically imposing as well, because as often as not, they're being required to be a third centre back in some of these attacking situations that they face. And of course, you know, in a very, very modern world, you'd be an absolute master of the tactical foul as well, because that's another thing they're required to do.
Well, yeah, Rodri, obviously the master at that. But I do think as well, people underestimate, in the same way, like you say, that a goalkeeper has to have a short memory and put mistakes out of their head, a striker has to put missed chances out of their head. Bissouma is very good at receiving the ball. He might lose it, but it doesn't faze him. It doesn't scare him. And I think that is something that really sets him apart. And whereas I think there have been some games, I think back to the FA Cup game against City, Højbjerg lost it a couple of times. There was one he lost to De Bruyne inside his own box. And on another day, De Bruyne scores. And that's far more remembered than it is. I don't know if he's got that same ability to just keep relentlessly demanding the ball from the centre-backs under huge pressure from the attackers. It's a really... It takes a lot of nerve to keep doing that.
It does. It does. I personally would pick Bissouma just because he's most used to it. I don't... Away from home, I'm not thrilled with the idea of Maddison, Benton, Kerr and Saar. It just strikes me that they'll get caught forward of the ball too often. I mean, as you say, with the pace of people like Anthony Gordon and Harvey Barnes, that wouldn't... But then, you know, I'm slightly negative about these things. I want teams to defend their goal properly as part of the game plan, but it just doesn't seem to be the modern way.
The other thing to say, Danny, is that this is such a cliche, but these are dilemmas that are great to have, and Newcastle are extremely envious of Spurs having
these
dilemmas.
We didn't have these problems in December and January,
exactly.
Did we, to be honest?
In December, it felt at times like we were kind of a Sunday league team scrabbling around for players. I mean, some of the in that combination of 19 midfield combos that I mentioned, there are some that you're like, yeah, we are never, ever, ever seeing that again.
Well, that's called the skip and file, isn't it?
Newcastle is still injury ravaged in a way that Spurs were, you know. So they, you know, and I think Joe Linton is a big miss for them. So I think the great thing is, Spurs have these options, and also with five subs now, the starting 11 isn't the be-all and end-all that it once was. You know, he was able to hook two of his central midfielders at half-time, Postecoglou. He did that against Brentford as well in the win at the end of January, and that worked out well. So I think all five of these guys that we're talking about could well have a big part to play, even though only three of them will start.
Forgive me while I mention his name. Is Ollie Skip injured, or is he just not anywhere near the first team squad anymore? No, amazing.
I don't think so. I mean, I looked at this for the piece. He started against Brentford in that game in late January, came on as a late sub against Everton in early Feb, and hasn't played since. And yeah, isn't making matchday squads at the moment. But that speaks, you know, you look at the Spurs bench, it's really strong. When you think as well, they've got Lo Celso and Kulusevski on the bench the last couple of games. That's four players added to Højbjerg and Bentancur who can play central midfield. So there's a huge amount of competition there.
I was trying to think of the last time Spurs had a bench that strong. And even in the sort of challenging for the title Champions League runs years under Pochettino, I wasn't sure that we had a bench as strong as they currently have. At least in theory.
Yeah, well, it will get stronger this weekend as well if Richarlison's back, because you'll basically replace Scarlett with Richarlison.
Yeah.
If Richarlison started, I don't think he'd be fit enough, then one of the other guys. But also, just as a contrast, when Spurs beat Newcastle in December, that period we're talking about, and this was actually when the injury crisis was easing a teeny bit, but Spurs' bench that day was Donnelly, Valise, Lo Celso, Hill, Højbjerg, Skip, Dorrington, Royale, Forster.
Emerson Royal's wearing the captain's armband there, isn't he? Let's be honest.
Yeah, exactly.
To move on, just before Christmas, you, Charlie, and Charlotte Harper got to spend a week behind the scenes with Tottenham's women's team. And really, really fun and revealing it was too. You can read that article. It was in December on The Athletic. Maybe it was quite ambitious to think that they would be playing an FA Cup semi-final. It's against Leicester. 12 o'clock kickoff on Sunday. Back then, you probably would have that would have been at the edges of their ambitions. But there they are, Charlie. And a huge game for the women's team at the club.
Yeah, massive. And would urge as many people to go if they can. It should be a really fun occasion at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. Yeah, I'm really pleased for them, because you did get the sense back then that, you know, this was part of a long-term project. I mean, lots of similarities with the men's team, with their manager, Robert Willem, who's a really interesting guy, really, you know, generous with his time when we were there, just chatting constantly. And yeah, he's committed to a kind of similar philosophy to Postecoglou, likes the team to play out. I mean, you might remember, I think it was the day after that interview went up, they beat Arsenal in the North London Derby at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. And the goal they scored was like, the perfect encapsulation of how Willem wants the team to play, which he tweeted about after. So yeah, this is a really big occasion for them. And yeah, maybe even is ever so slightly ahead of schedule, a real opportunity for them to get to the final. And it should be a good game. They've got lots of really fun players to watch. They play really attractive football. You know, when you have time like Charlotte and I did, you do feel quite invested and you get to know the players and the coaches and all the people around it. And lots of really good people involved. Yeah, wish them all the best.
Looking at the WSL table, and I don't want to balk this, as people south of the river say, they're significantly better than Leicester, at least, you know, in the league. But this would be their first FA Cup final. So, as Charlie says, it's not 70 quid to go either. So it's in the main stadium. Go and have a watch, and we can only wish them all the best. We also have a little bit of news here that the Premier League have now rearranged that missing fixture against Manchester City. It is now Tuesday the 14th of May, an 8 o'clock kickoff. This will be the last home game then, will be against Manchester City. It might be absolutely meaningless. Hopefully we'll have qualified for the Champions League by then. The problem here is we won't get, people won't be able to stay behind at the stadium to cheer the players for what's turning out to be a pretty decent season. But more importantly, would it be the first time that we'd have Arsenal's possibility of winning the title in our hands since we went to Old Trafford and took the lead? Was it Les Ferdinand who scored?
It was Les Ferdinand, yeah. I spoke to him about that years after.
Oh, my God.
Because I was kind of expecting, I said to him, like, you know, obviously, you know, the whole fan thing at that point was like, oh, we can't win this game. But I asked him, like, what about you as players? He was like, oh, yeah, we were well aware of that. And he said he thought when he scored, he was like, I'm never going to live this down if we win. It would be really interesting because I just can't believe Postecoglou, especially at home and the way he is, even if Spurs are qualified for the Champions League, I still don't think there'll be any let up. The idea would absolutely revolt him of like, yeah, let's just go easy on this one.
It revolts me too, you know. Spurs should try and win every game they play, you know. But although, again, people slightly younger than myself, when I get into a tizzy when people put out weakened teams at the end of the season, and people say, yeah, but they're safe in the league. They've earned their right to put out any old pony team. I'm not sure that the integrity of the competition is best served by that attitude.
I completely agree with both of you on this. And I think that the way that these things will get talked about means that I'm sure that in advance of the game, people will ask, mm-hmm. Are you guys really trying to win? Do you really want to win? And it will become a narrative. And that narrative will actually make the players even more committed to trying to get a result because people in football just naturally get kind of prickly and defensive when it's suggested of them that they might not be motivated for any particular reason.
Yes, I can't imagine the atmosphere in Kelly Towers if Arsenal needs a result from Spurs. So I'm trying my best to think that all those things will be settled by the time they get to that late in the season. But as I sometimes say to people, you know, in exactly these sort of conversations, the truth is, and I speak as somebody who, because of where I'm from and because of my family, is absolutely embedded in Arsenal's stories and narratives and all the rest of it. At the end of the day, Spurs fans shouldn't worry about Arsenal. What the hell? We've got no control over what Arsenal do. Spurs want to worry about being the best Spurs they can be. And if I may misquote all the managers, let's see where that takes us. But sitting around worrying about throwing games so as to stop them winning a title, it does nothing for me at all. I must say, in fact, it's leaving a horrible taste in my mouth. Win the game, whatever happens after that, it happens. We'll have a quick break again. When we come back, I want to talk about, we didn't get a chance to, when I announced that Mickey van de Ven's goal was my favourite Spurs goal of all time, people got onto us on social media and said, hang on, and we were talking particularly about long-range thunderbolt shots. We're going to have a quick chat about that when we come back. You'll listen to Jack and Charlie and me, Danny, here on The View from the Lane. Yeah, welcome back, everybody. Let's talk about Thunderbastards. It's one of the ways in which these compound, Charlie would probably use the word portmanteau words to describe fantastically hit shots that go in tremendous velocity. Howitzers rather than mortars, I think, is the phrase I'd look for here. First of all, you have to see the evolution. There used to be net busters, and Thunderbolts. Now you have to take one half of the portmanteau word has to be slightly rude. In this case, bastard, shitping, as you know, the kind of things I'm talking about. It was a great goal by Mickey van der Ven, but there have been many. People immediately said, what about Victor Wanyama's effort against Liverpool? I'm going to go back into the Mr. Time for mine, but Jack, can you remember, just to mention one or two more, because otherwise we're in danger of leaving out some lovely historical moments here. Jack has screwed up his face, so I bet Charlie's done his homework. And
yeah, this is I have not done my homework on this occasion.
Well, you can go to the back of the class then, and I'm going and that gold star I gave you last week, I'm going to scrape it off your exercise book. Do people still have exercise books? I doubt it. Charlie, what about you? Can you remember real humdingers?
Yeah, I mean, this might almost be too far out that it kind of lost some of its thunderbastardness, but the Eric Edmund one against Liverpool from about 35 yards. In 2005, that he absolutely levered.
Yeah.
Just a ridiculous goal from so far out. I would put in that category. I mean, Wanyama was the first one that came to mind. That Wanyama one is just the archetypal thunderbolt. That's the only way to describe that goal.
It was very, very satisfying, wasn't it, that goal?
Yeah, it really was.
And of course, because the source was unusual, which I'm coming on to very soon, all the more wonderful for that, you know?
Mm.
I've got a very short list for you here. I've got absolute... I mean, I'm going back into the mists of time somewhat, but please bear with me. I'm going to talk about... This is a list, Danny Kelly's list of two absolute thunder wangers, which were the only goal scored by Spurs players. One is, I think, just about this century, so you'll help me with this. Mabizela against Leicester. Anyone remember that?
Yeah, that was the one I was thinking of. Yeah, that was ridiculous, that one.
That
yeah.
was on his debut and one of...
Against Leicester,
I think against
it?
Leicester. My mind is telling me Leicester. Yeah. And yeah. one of only 9 or 10 appearances. 9, I'm thinking, that he made for Spurs. But less than a dozen, anyway. And on his debut, he wanged that one in against Leicester. 2003 was that.
2003, yeah, it was a ridiculous
right.
goal.
People, though, and I'll end this off with, people of a much older vintage, I'm taking you back into the last year of the 1970s now, Spurs bought Terry Yorath, who had had a brilliant career for Leeds and Wales as a midfield destroyer, and Spurs bought him in the twilight of his career, I think it's fair to say. Went on to, of course, manage Wales for years, but managed both Cardiff and Swansea, I think, and of course is the father of Gabby Yorath. Yeah. On the TV these days. Terry Yorath played for 2, maybe 3 seasons for Spurs with minimum distinction, really. He was, I'd say, coming to the end of his career. But he scored one goal against Bolton Wanderers at the Lane in a 2-0 win, coming up right up to half-time. And I can remember the goal as clear as day. That is to say, I can hardly remember it at all. But I know that in my mind, it was an absolutely astonishing shot from far out. I spent the last 2 days... confirming with people of a certain age that yes, he did, and it was an amazing shot. I think it was a volley from about 30 yards, but the internet has let me down here. I can't find any filmic moving image of it. But people listening to my voice of a certain vintage will definitely remember that Yorath's only goal to match Mabazela's only goal was an absolute wanger from massive distance, and Yorath played like a dirty version of Højbjerg. So it was a surprise when this one went flying into the net.
There was the Asuakotu.
Oh, we're forgetting Danny Rose as well here, aren't we?
Oh, 9-10. Yeah, there's Rose as well.
I was going to say Danny Rose against
Rose,
Arsenal.
Yeah, Rose, because it's a volley. I don't know. That feels slightly different category.
It's 45 yards out,
Charlie. He did hit it really hard.
It does go really hard.
Yeah, I think Asuakotu is purer as a thunderbolt.
And are we all losing our minds for not mentioning Tom Huddleston at some stage here?
Yeah, I was going to mention Huddleston against City, Huddleston against Arsenal. The thing is, he kind of hits the ball in such a way that he doesn't absolutely thump it, but he just clips it in this perfect way, which means that it has an awful lot of momentum. Like, it goes he hits it in a very true way, but it's not like... he's not hitting it with maximum power. He's just hitting it so cleanly.
He's an amazing striker of football, wasn't he? Amazing.
That City goal is, I think, one of the best goals in Premier League history. It's absolutely extraordinary how he hits that. That's a very different category. That shouldn't be lumped in with these
goals.
Okay,
thank you very much, Neve, for that. Just one thought about this as well. Modern balls are slightly different. The ball has changed all through the history of the game. But we all know that when you slow the strike of a football down to very, very, very slowly, you can see that the striker's boot, shoe, whatever he or she is wearing, goes into the ball. It actually buried into the ball, and the ball bounces away from the shot. I do want to see a scientific, very slowed down version. And you're all out there with your, you're all so brilliant on the internet. Let's see this. I want to see Van de Ven's foot going through that ball. Maybe the modern balls are so light that you don't quite get that thing of the ball going right, the foot going right into the ball before it takes off. We've had a lot of business to get through there, so well done to you two. We'll have another podcast in a few days' time, and hopefully Spurs will have got some kind of positive result at Newcastle. Because I think Aston Villa's game is against Arsenal, isn't it? So there's an opportunity. Of course, Villa can beat Arsenal. There's an opportunity to open a bit of gap here in this arm wrestle for fourth place. Although, of course, the Spurs manager would remind me Spurs can still win the title. They're one of five teams who still can. Just to remind you that the show has its own official home on Twitter at VFTL Podcast, and you can email us at the VFTL@theathletic.com. For the best Spurs coverage anywhere, and I hope I'm not flattering my colleagues here, Charlie and Jack are absolutely central to that. Many more excellent writers contribute as well. The best Spurs coverage is at The Athletic, so make sure you sign up to the product itself. We'll be back, as I say, in just a few days' time. God bless you all. Come on, you Spurs.
The Athletic.